Hi, you're listening to Screen of the Crime.
I'm Tess.
And I'm Maggie, and this is a podcast where we talk about true crime.
And what would happen if your favorite TV and movie characters committed those crimes.
It's our 51st episode now.
Yeah, when I was making the file title, I was like 51, because I never ever know the numbers, but this time I did. So yeah.
All right, so this episode's gonna be sad.
Yeah, I don't know. I will wait. I guess we can get into it once you get into the case, but I don't know how this is like a... I don't know. It seems really sad to be, like, a true crime thing. I guess it's, like, true and
it's seems
crime.
Really sad to be a true crime thing. It's a crime.
Yeah. I guess it's just, like,
I think all true crimes are sad, but this one's just extremely sad in its nature.
Yeah.
Because of the time period and the amount of fatalities.
Yes.
And just the overall, I don't know, politics kind of surrounding it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But before we get into this depressing episode, what'd you do this week?
Well, it's Monday, so nothing.
Yeah,
yet.
What'd you do between last Tuesday and Monday?
Between
last update our audience.
What did I do? Okay, well, what did I do this weekend? I went apple picking.
We
went apple picking. It's on our Instagram. Check it out. Give it a like. Which was really fun. I have to figure out something to make with all the apples.
I think I'm gonna make those, like, you know, you kind of buy, like, the puff pastry, like, croissant things, and you make, like, mini apple pies.
Oh, that'd be cute.
Because I didn't buy that many apples, like, I didn't pick that many.
Yeah.
So I think making smaller ones would be nice. Also, like, I can't fit a whole apple pie in my fridge.
Yeah. I was thinking of making, like, apple cake or something, like, carrot cake, but with apples.
I like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that... will be an update. What else happened this weekend? Saturday, I just did homework all day until me and my roommates stopped doing homework and then binge-watched the entire season of Big Mouth, the new one that just came out. And we all were, like, very productive that day. And then, like, it just kind of at one point could not do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, in the night, we just were kind of, like, it said, oh, no more episodes, and we all just looked at each other like, wow, we really just did that, huh? God, a whole season of Big Mouth in one sitting.
I wish that was me. I don't even have time to do homework, and I'm upset about that. I'm a student first, but I volunteered with my fraternity at the Willow Walk a Mile in My Shoes. We raised so much money, and it was super fun.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always cold there, but that's kind of, like, nice because it really makes you want to get active, you know?
Yeah, warm yourself up.
Yeah. It's not, like, hot out when you're like, oh, I don't want to do anything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we always have a fun time there. It's our second year in a row working for them. And it's a good time.
Yeah.
It's on the lake.
Oh, I love walking on lakes.
Yeah, it's right down in, what's that town? Charlotte?
Oh, I don't know.
It's by that ice cream place that everyone talks
about. Like Lake Ontario Beach Park?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's where it is, yeah.
Abbott's is, I think.
Abbott's, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. No, yeah. I want to go outdoors this weekend.
I want to go to Letchworth.
I want to go there too. I meant to ask you about that actually off the podcast just because I was wanting to do it, but I want to, because one of my roommates will be gone this weekend to go to a wedding. And I was like, hey, other roommate, let's do a boys trip and go hiking. And it's not a boys trip because I'm not a boy, but, like, you know, it's a trip. So,
yeah.
The Grand Canyon of New York.
Yep, that's what my mom keeps telling me.
So, yeah, I want to go to the Grand Canyon of New York.
I can't go this weekend, though.
Okay, well...
I'm sorry. I have been so very busy, and I only have, like... This weekend's our fall break, so we have 4 days of weekend. But one of those days, I'm doing community service with you. Mm-hmm. And then another one is an open house for our college, so...
Oh, yeah.
I really only have 2 days, and I need to get a shit ton of homework done, because I've been putting it off, because I haven't been available.
Yeah.
I told... Nicole was like, what'd you do this weekend? Our boss. And I was like, I volunteered, and then I went apple picking and stuff like that. She's like, what are you doing over fall break? You going back to Florida? And I was like, no, I have to volunteer and work an open house. She's like, sounds like someone doesn't know how to say no. And I'm like... You have no fucking idea.
That's true.
I don't know. Yeah. There's just a lot happening all the time.
There is. Well.
Anyway, I'm really sorry I'm eating a sandwich while we record this podcast. So if you hear me...
eating a sandwich.
That is what I'm doing.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what else to say. I, like, blacked out the whole week.
Me too. I can't recall what I did. Oh, I went to a social media convention.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, I spent 2 days in downtown Rochester at Upstate Social Sessions, which is a social media convention, and they had all these cool speakers. We had a lovely lady, I need to find her name, from Bon Appetit magazine.
It's like Emily Schultz, right?
Yes, that's her name.
Yeah.
And... what am I saying? And she was so fun, and she's the social media coordinator, person, runner, lady for Bon Appetit's, like, all their social media, but not including their YouTube channel. That's a different team.
Mm-hmm.
It's her and one other lady, and she's so fun, and she's so cool, and she's an RIT alumni, and I don't know what her major was, but...
She was advertising photography.
Of course she was. And Bon Appetit is so cool, and they also run... She runs Basically, which is a sister... company or whatever, sister social media platform of Bon Appetit, and there's Healthy-ish, which is another sister company. Then we also heard from people from the Kodakery podcast, which is Kodak's podcast. And when I told my dad about it, because I was on the phone, I was like, I got a photo with people from the Kodakery podcast, and I was like, you know Kodak? And he's like, yeah, they fired me. Did you tell them you fired my father? And I was like... No.
I heard the most bullshit fact today, and it turned out to not be true.
Oh, what was it?
It was, someone said to me, because this sunset was really pretty today.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And Sean, my roommate, goes, he's like, reason the sunsets are always so pretty in Rochester is because of Kodak, like, releasing all these chemicals to make, like, the sky all wax. So, like, that's why it always looks like nice clouds. And then...
That's not true.
And then we looked it up and it was not true.
Because in Florida, the sunsets are really pretty, too.
Yeah, and also, that's just not how that works.
Mm-hmm.
There's your lady.
Oh, I love her.
Yeah, I'm just looking through Emily Schultz's Instagram. I'm gonna follow it.
I follow it, too. And then we talked to a man from Rise Collective, which is a media company. And he followed me on Twitter.
Ooh.
I know.
Exciting.
It's because, I don't know if I sent it to you. There's this list from Upstate Social released on Twitter about, like, the most active users. Like, it was most active influencers for Upstate Social. And I was on the list. Like, and it was really funny because when the list goes down, it's like, Upstate Social Sessions, like, the Twitter, like, you know, the people that run it. Then next is my professor, Mikey Joe. And then they all have, like, 33,000 followers. And underneath it's just me with my 33 followers. 33. I'm like, I'm an influencer now.
Just those people look at it, just be like, oh, it's a typo. They forgot the K. You actually have 33,000 followers.
I was like, I'm an influencer, because we've been joking, me and my roommates, about being an influencer, because the conference ended with a TikTok influencer coming on stage, and it was so, I'm not going to say stupid, but I feel like I didn't learn much, but he was a fun man.
Mm-hmm. How old was he?
I don't know, like 35, maybe. He's a teacher.
I feel like I know who you're talking about.
His name is Chaz Bruce, I think.
Listen, I've watched a lot of TikTok compilations.
He does a lot of dancing ones.
I've seen, like, some, like, cringy ones.
He does a lot of chip ones, too.
Mm.
And he, like, opens a bag of chip, and someone's like, can I have some? And he's like, you ain't getting no chips, or whatever.
Whack.
Yeah. But I'm in one of his TikToks. So if you can find me, I'm wearing an orange shirt and a cardigan.
There you go.
Send me screenshots.
Yeah. Just zoom all the way in.
Yeah.
I'll try and find it. I'll
just be a blurry person.
Yeah. Speaking of, also with influencers, I forgot to tell you, I had to do a presentation at 9 a.m. this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to be there at all. I felt like a rat, and I was a rat. But I pulled through. But anyways, like, the group that went after us presenting, they had, like, their presentation, they went really hard with it.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, kind of to the point where, like, they didn't need to go that hard.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it was an advertising presentation, and, like, it was working with this local company. But, like, one of their, like, things that they were talking about was influencer marketing. I'm like,
yeah.
I'm like, I guess, but
it's a big thing.
It's a big thing, but, like, I feel like they, like, all of their advice that they were giving to these people was, like, completely not realistic at all. They were like, remodel your whole store and redo everything. And
but
like,
that's what I've had the same teacher. I've taken the same classes test, but it was last year. And that's what he loves.
I know. But I'm like, they have no money. Don't tell them these things.
It's not like they're going to take your tips or anything.
No, but they were writing vigorous notes and asking a lot of questions and interrupting people during the
presentation. We told this one company, we were like, to be frank, your website, it sucks. And he's like, I love that. yeah.
They were a little defensive about their website. Like, they were very defensive with a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we would suggest something and they'd be like, well, like, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, we're just suggesting it. Tell me all about it. We don't know anything about what we're supposed to be doing right now.
Anyway, if you guys want to learn any more about who I listened to speak at the conference, you can go on my Twitter and see all the 80 million tweets I had to do for an assignment while at the conference. You can also see photos of me with other young adults, young professionals.
Ooh, yeah.
In the marketing field.
If you want to see the face of anxiety, go on there.
It's me standing next to some cool kids having a panic attack. I guess we should get into this episode.
Yeah.
I have a quiz to take after this.
I have a whole bunch of things to do.
All right. So, I apologize if I say anything that would upset anyone. Well, talking about this, also, we're doing the San Ysidro McDonald's Massacre. I'm going to be saying a lot of names. I'm really bad at names.
Mm-hmm.
So, if I missay a name, please don't be angry at me. All respect to the victims and the families. Okay, let's go.
Okay.
Before the incident. On July 15th, 1984, James Hubert, Huberty, wow, fucked up already, commented to his wife, Etna, that he suspected he might have a mental problem.
Okay.
2 days later, on the morning of July 17th, he called San Diego Mental Health Clinic requesting an appointment. Leaving his contact details with the receptionist, he was assured that the clinic would return his call within hours. So I have to zoom in. I can't read. According to his wife, he sat quietly beside the telephone for several hours, awaiting the return call, before abruptly walking out of the family home and riding to an unknown destination on his motorcycle. Unbeknownst to Huberty, the receptionist had misspelled his name as Huberty, with an SH.
Mm.
His polite demeanor conveyed no sense of urgency to the operator, and he had elaborated in the phone call that he had never been hospitalized for mental health issues. Therefore, the call had been logged as a non-crisis inquiry to be handled within 48 hours.
Okay. But it was a crisis inquiry.
Approximately 1 hour later, Huberty returned home in a content mood. After eating dinner, Huberty, his wife, and two daughters, aged 12 and 10, cycled to a nearby park. Later that evening, he and Edna watched a film together on their television. July 18th, 1984.
Wait, where do you go?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know where you went. I don't think it's relevant.
Okay.
He just left. The following morning, Wednesday, July 18th, Huberty, his wife, and children visited the San Diego Zoo. You ever been there?
Mm-hmm.
Is it nice?
It is nice.
That's fun.
Yeah.
Sorry, everyone, from my copywriting and visualizations class is messaging me right now.
Oh.
Separately. Now.
They're all DMing you.
Yeah. In the course of their walk through the zoo, Huberti told his wife that he believed that his life was effectively over. Referring to the mental health clinic's failure to return his phone call the previous day, he said, "Well, society had their chance."
Well.
After eating lunch at a McDonald's restaurant in the Claremont neighborhood of San Diego, the Huberti family returned home. Shortly thereafter, Huberti... What if I'm pronouncing his name wrong this whole time?
It's too late to go back.
Huberti walked to his bedroom wearing a maroon t-shirt and... walked into his bedroom wearing a maroon t-shirt and green camouflage slacks. As his wife lay relaxing upon their bed, he leaned down towards Edna and said, "I want to kiss you goodbye." Edna kissed her husband, then asked him where he was going, stating her intention to soon prepare a family dinner.
Okay.
Want to do a little role play? No. Huberti calmly replied he was going hunting. Hunting for humans.
That...
Direct quote.
Oh, fuck. Okay.
Carrying a bundle wrapped in a checkered blanket, Huberti glanced towards his elder daughter, Zelia.
Okay.
As he walked towards the front door of the family home and said, "Goodbye, I won't be back." Huberti then drove down San Ysidro Boulevard. According to eyewitnesses, he drove first towards the Big Bear supermarket, then towards a U.S. Post Office branch, before entering the parking lot of a McDonald's restaurant approximately 200 yards from his Avril Road apartment. I'm gonna eat this last bite.
Okay. This is really fucked up so far, dare I say.
Oh, get ready.
Like, I understand what you're saying, where it's like, all true crime is fucked up, but I think there's just something very... what's the word? Like, this is something that's, like, just in America today is so, like... Because, like, serial killers, it's, like, very sensationalized, but, like, the probability is, like, very low versus, like... If you're in America today, I feel like if you're in, like, a big public space, you're always kind of just, like, paranoid. At least I am, you know?
As someone from the South, specifically Florida, who has very lax gun laws... Like, my brother, I believe, owns an assault rifle.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a school shooting very close to my high school, like, the year after I got out from high school, and it really affected everyone in the community, as everyone does know. And, like, there's shootings, like, every month, and we've become so immune to it. This one is really, it's scary, because it happens so much, and this... goes really into detail about it. Like, you feel like you're there. And it's, like, it's very scary. Because I know how to avoid a serial killer, you know? Don't go alone with anyone.
Don't
go into dark alleys.
Yeah.
Don't talk to strangers. This one, they're just at McDonald's.
Yeah, like, there's nothing you can...
There's nothing they could have done.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, let's get into this.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, my God. All right.
There's a gun in here, and I'm going to call it an Uzi, because that's how I think it's pronounced. Actually, I'm going to look it up.
That's how it's pronounced.
It is, you know, for a fact.
I don't know for a fact, but I'm pretty sure.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to type it in.
How is it spelled?
Uzi.
Yeah, it's Uzi.
Pronounced.
Because, you know, the rapper, Lil Uzi Vert?
No.
Okay. Well, that's
obvious. Give it a minute.
Uzi.
Uzi.
Yep.
All right, here we go, baby. At approximately 3:56 p.m. on July 18th, Huberti drove his black Mercedes Marquis sedan into the parking lot of a McDonald's restaurant on San Ysidro Boulevard. In his possession was a 9mm Browning HP semi-automatic pistol, a 9mm Uzi carbine, a Winchester 1200, 12-gauge pump-action shotgun, and a cloth bag filled with hundreds of rounds of ammunition for each weapon. We got four weapons.
Oh, boy.
Right? we have three weapons. A total of 45 customers were present inside the restaurant. Entering the restaurant, minutes later, Huberti first aimed his shotgun at 16-year-old employee named John Arnold. As he did so, the assistant manager, Guillermo Flores, shouted, "Hey, John, that guy's gonna shoot you!" According to Arnold, when Huberti pulled the trigger, nothing happened. As Huberti inspected his gun, the manager of the restaurant, 22-year-old Neva Kane, walked towards the service counter of the restaurant in the direction of Arnold, as Arnold, believing the incident to be a distasteful joke, began to walk away from the gunman. Huberti fired the shotgun towards the ceiling before aiming the Uzi at Kane, shooting her once beneath her left eye. Kane died minutes later. Immediately after shooting Kane, Huberti fired a shotgun at Arnold, wounding the teenager in the chest and arm before shouting a comment to the effect of, "Everybody on the ground." Huberti referred to all present in the restaurant as dirty swine, Vietnam assholes, before claiming that he had killed 1,000 and that he intended to kill 1,000 more. Upon hearing Huberti's profane rant and seeing Kane and Arnold shot, one customer, 25-year-old Victor Rivera, tried to persuade Huberti not to shoot anyone else. In response, Huberti shot Rivera 14 times, repeatedly shouting, "Shut up," as Rivera screamed in pain. As staff and customers tried to hide beneath tables and service booths, Huberti turned his attention towards six women and children huddled together. He first killed 19-year-old Maria Colmenro Silva with a single shot, a gunshot to the chest, then fatally shot 9-year-old Claudia Perez in the stomach, cheek, thigh, hip, leg, chest, back, armpit, and head with his Uzi. He then wounded Perez's 15-year-old sister, Emilda, once in the chest with the same weapon and fired upon 11-year-old Aurora Pena with his shotgun. Pena? Initially wounded in the leg, had been shielded by her pregnant aunt, 18-year-old Jackie Reyes. Huberti shot Reyes 48 times with the Uzi. 48 times! Is an Uzi like an automatic? Is it like a...
Yeah.
Okay. Beside his mother's body, 8-month-old Carlos Reyes sat up and wailed, whereupon Huberti shouted at the child, then killed the baby with a single pistol shot to the center of the back. Huberti then shot and killed 62-year-old trucker named Lawrence Versluis. Sorry about that last name. Before targeting a family seated near the play area of the restaurant who had tried to shield their son and his friend beneath the tables with their bodies. 31-year-old Blythe Regan Herrera had shielded her 11-year-old son, Mateo, beneath one booth as her husband, Ronald, protected Mateo's friend, 12-year-old Keith Thomas, beneath a booth directly across from them. Ronald Herrera urged Thomas not to move, shielding the boy with his body. Thomas was shot in the shoulder, arm, and wrist and left elbow, but was not seriously wounded. Ronald Herrera was shot 8 times in the stomach, chest, arm, and head, but survived. His wife, Blythe, and son, Mateo, were both killed by numerous gunshots to the head. Nearby, three women had also attempted to hide beneath a booth. 24-year-old Guadalupe de Rio lay against a wall. She was shielded by her friend, 25-year-old Gloria Ramirez, and 31-year-old Aristodelcia Vulvas Vargas. Del Rio was hit several times but not seriously wounded. Ramirez was unhurt, whereas Vargas received a single gunshot wound to the back of the head. She died of her wound the next day. She was the only person fatally wounded who lived long enough to reach a hospital. At another booth, Huberti killed 45-year-old banker Hugo Velasquez, that's his name, with a single shot to the chest. The first of many calls to emergency services was made shortly after 4 p.m., notifying police of the shooting of a child who had been taken to a post office on San Ysidro Boulevard. The dispatcher mistakenly directed responding officers to another McDonald's 2 miles from that restaurant. This error delayed the imposition of the lockdown by several minutes, and the only warning by civilians walking, riding, or driving towards the restaurant were given by passerbys. Shortly after 4 o'clock, a young woman named Lydia Flores drove into the parking lot, stopping at the food pickup window. Flores noticed shattered windows and the sound of gunfire before, quote, looking up and there he was just shooting. Flores reversed her car until she crashed into a fence. She hid with her 2-year-old daughter until the shooting ended. 3 11-year-old boys then rode their bikes into the west parking lot to purchase sundaes. Hearing a member of the public yell something unintelligible from across the street, all three hesitated before Huberti shot the 3 boys with the shotgun and Uzi. Joshua Coleman fell to the ground, critically wounded in the back, arm, and leg. He later recalled looking towards his 2 friends, Omar Alonso Hernandez and David Flores Delgado, noting that Hernandez was on the ground with multiple gunshot wounds to his back, and he started vomiting. Delgado had received several gunshot wounds to his head. Coleman survived. Hernandez and Delgado both died at the scene. Huberti next noticed an elderly couple, 74-year-old Miguel Victoria Ayo and 69-year-old Aida Velasquez Victoria walking towards the entrance. As Miguel reached to open the door for his wife, Huberti fired his shotgun, killing Aida with the gunshot to the face and wounding Miguel. An uninjured survivor, Oscar Mondragon, later reported observing Miguel cradling his wife in his arms and wiping blood from her face, shouting curses at Huberti, who then approached the doorway and killed him with a shot to the head. At approximately 4:10 p.m., a Mexican couple, Astolfo and Marcela Felix, drove towards one of the service areas of the restaurant. Noting the shattered laminated glass, Astolfo initially assumed the renovation work was in progress and that Huberti striding towards their car was a repairman. Huberti shot a shotgun and Uzi at the couple and their 4-month-old daughter, Carlita, striking Marcela in the face, arms, and chest, blinding her in one eye and permanently rendering one hand unusable. Her baby was critically wounded in the neck, chest, and abdomen. Astolfo was wounded in the chest and head. As Astolfo and Marcela staggered away from Huberti's line of fire, Marcela gave their baby to her husband. Astolfo handed the baby to a young woman named Lucia Velasco as his wife collapsed against the car. The woman with the baby rushed the baby to the nearby hospital as her husband assisted Astolfo and Marcela into a nearby building. All 3 members of the Felix family survived. Yay for them. Okay.
Damn.
Here come the police! Okay. At approximately 10 minutes after the first call had been placed to the emergency services, police arrived at the correct McDonald's restaurant. The first officer on the scene was Miguel Rosario, rapidly determining the location and cause of the actual disturbance and relaying this information to the San Diego Police Department. Officers deployed immediately imposed a lockdown on an area spanning 6 blocks from the site of the shooting. The police established a command post 2 blocks from the restaurant, deployed 175 officers in numerous strategic positions. It's the word locations. I don't know why I said positions. These officers were joined within the hour by several SWAT team members, who also took positions around the restaurant. As Huberti was firing rapidly and alternating between firearms of differing calibers, police initially were unaware how many individuals were inside the restaurant. Furthermore, because most of the restaurant's windows had been shattered by gunfire, reflections from shards of glass provide an additional difficulty for police to focus inside the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, police were concerned the gunmen, maybe holding hostages, although one individual who had escaped from the restaurant informed police there was a single gunman present in the premises holding no hostages and shooting any individual he encountered. A 27-year-old police SWAT sniper named Charles Foster was positioned on the roof of the post office next to the McDonald's. As with all responding law enforcement personnel, Foster was authorized to kill the perpetrator should he obtain a clear shot. Several survivors later reported observing Huberti walk towards the service counter and adjust a portable radio, possibly to search for new reports of a shooting spree, before selecting a music station and further shooting individuals as he danced to the music. Shortly thereafter, Huberti searched the kitchen area, discovering 6 employees and shouting, "Oh, there's more! You're trying to hide from me?" In response, one of the female employees screamed in Spanish, "Don't kill me, don't kill me," before Huberti opened fire, killing 21-year-old Paulina Lopez, 19-year-old Elisa Borboa Fierro, and 18-year-old Margarita Padilla, and critically wounding 17-year-old Alberto Leos. Immediately before Huberti had begun shooting, Padilla grabbed the hand of her friend and colleague, 17-year-old Wendy Flanagan, before the two began to run. Padilla was then fatally shot. Flanagan, four other employees, and a female customer hid inside a basement utility room. They were later joined by Leos, who had crawled to the utility room after being shot five times. When a fire engine truck drove within range, Huberti opened fire and repeatedly pierced the vehicle with bullets, slightly wounding one occupant. Hearing a wounded teenager, 19-year-old Jose Perez, moaning, Huberti shot him in the head. The boy slumped dead in the booth. Perez died alongside his friend and neighbor, 22-year-old Gloria Gonzalez, and a young woman named Michelle Carncross. At one point, Aurora Pena had lain wounded beside her dead aunt, baby cousin, and two friends, noting a lull in the firing. She opened her eyes and saw Huberti nearby staring at her. He swore, threw a bag of french fries at her, then retrieved his shotgun and shot Pena in the arm, neck, and jaw. Aurora Pena survived, although she would remain hospitalized longer than any other survivor. But she survived. At 5:17 p.m., Huberti walked from the service counter towards the doorway close to the drive-in window of the restaurant, affording Foster an unobstructed view of his body from the neck down within through his telescopic sight. He fired a single round from a range of approximately 35 yards. The bullet entered Huberti's chest, severed his aorta just under his heart, and exited through his spine, leaving an exit wound 1 inch square and sending him sprawling backwards onto the floor directly in front of the service counter, killing him almost instantly. The incident had lasted for 77 minutes, during which time Huberti fired a minimum of 257 rounds of ammunition, killing 20 people and wounding as many others, one of whom died the following day. 17 of the victims were killed inside the restaurant and 4 in the immediate vicinity. Only 10 individuals inside the restaurant were uninjured, 6 of whom had hidden inside the basement utility room. Several victims had tried to stanch their bleeding with napkins, often in vain. Of the fatalities, 13 died from gunshot wounds to the head, 7 from gunshot wounds to the chest, and one victim, 8-month-old Carlos Reyes, from a single 9mm gunshot to the back. The victims, whose ages ranged from 4 months to 74 years, were predominantly, though not exclusively, Mexican or Mexican-American ancestry, reflecting local demographics. So it probably wasn't race-based.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're in San Diego. Initial reports issued by the San Diego Police Department following the massacre indicated Huberti had shot all injured or killed... indicated Huberti had shot all injured or killed within the restaurant in the initial minutes after he had first entered the restaurant. This claim was hotly disputed by survivors who stated Huberti had shot both wounded and unwounded people over 40 minutes after he had opened fire. Although Huberti had shouted at the beginning of his shooting spree that he had killed 1,000, in a comment indicating he was a veteran of the Vietnam War, he had never actually served in any military branch.
Okay, that...
it's weird.
That's what I was going to ask earlier, because I know, like, you had said that, and I, like, based on the timing, that would, you know, make sense,
mm-hmm.
but then, okay. Is there going to be any explanation to this?
I have more notes. I'm just eating the sandwich
okay.
right now.
Go ahead.
Take a moment to let that all sink in.
Holy fucking shit. What the fuck? Of all the notes you've done, and there's been some crazy ones that I'm just, like, a little uncomfortable, but this is, like...
Mm-hmm. It's upsetting.
Yeah.
Very upsetting.
Mm-hmm. Like, oof.
All right. Let's talk about this bitch. All right. James Oliver Huberti was born October 11th, 1942, in Canton, Ohio. The second of two children. When Huberti was 3 years old, he contracted portfolio. To minimize the debility of his ailment, he was required to wear steel and leather braces upon his legs. Although Huberti made a progressive recovery from this ailment, he would be afflicted with a mild limp for the remainder of his life. In 1950, Earl Huberti, which is his father, purchased a 155-acre farm in Mount Eaton. His mother refused to live in the rural location and refused to even view the property. Shortly thereafter, she abandoned her family to perform sidewalk preaching as a Pentecostal missionary in Tucson, Arizona.
Whack. Uh-huh. Okay.
I was about to pronounce Tucson very wrong. Huberti found his mother's abandonment emotionally devastating. His father would later recollect finding his son slumped against the family chicken coop, sobbing. Huberti was a sullen child with few friends and frequently targeted by bullies at Wayndale High School. He was an average scholar. He graduated 51st out of a class of 77 students in 1960. In 1962, Hubert enrolled at Malone College, where he initially studied sociology before opting to study at the Pittsburgh Institute of Mortuary Science in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. In early 1965, Huberti married Etna Markland, whom he had met while attending Malone College. Shortly after his marriage, Huberti obtained his license for embalming and obtained employment at a funeral home in Canton. He worked in his profession for 2 years before opting to become a welder for Babcock and Wilcox in June of 1969. Shortly thereafter, he and his wife moved to a 3-story home in an affluent section of Massillon, Ohio, where his daughters Zelia and Cassandra were born in 1972 and 1974, respectively. Huberti had a history of domestic violence, frequently slapping his daughters or punching his wife. On one occasion, Etna filed a report with the Canton Department of Children and Family Services stating that her husband had messed up her jaw, although she later insisted on the majority of occasions he had assaulted her, he struck her only once. Beginning in 1976, Etna repeatedly attempted to persuade her husband to seek counseling to relieve his source of stress, although he refused to seek any form of therapy. In personal efforts to pacify her husband's temper, anxiety, and general paranoia, and to both influence and control his behavior, Etna gradually developed a mechanism whereby she claimed to be able to read his future by reading, playing, or tarot cards. Huberti believed her. Etna's readings would produce a temporary calming effect, and Huberti would typically follow the recommendations his wife made in these readings. To his neighbors and coworkers, Huberti was perceived as a sullen, ill-tempered, and somewhat paranoid individual, obsessed with firearms, and who harbored a mental tally of every setback, insult, or general source of frustration, real or perceived, against himself or his family within his mind. I mean, occasionally, Huberti would retaliate in response to any real or perceived injustice in an effort to settle what he termed my debts. On one occasion, he is known to have informed the father of two girls whom he had encouraged his daughters to fight in response to a conflict between the children, quote, "I believe in paying my debts, both good and bad." A conspiracy theorist and self-proclaimed survivalist, Huberti believed an escalation of the Cold War was inevitable and that President Ronald Reagan and the United States government were conspiring against him.
Against him personally?
Against him.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Just him. He is also known to have vocalized his belief that the country wasn't treating him right and that everything was being done against the working people. Convinced that Soviet aggression was expanding, Huberti believed that a breakdown of a society was imminent, perhaps through an economic collapse or a nuclear war. He committed himself to prepare to survive this perceived collapse and provisioned his house with an ample reserve supply of non-perishable food and 6 guns that he intended to use to defend his home during what he believed was the coming apocalypse. According to one family acquaintance named Jim Aslins, Huberti's home was bedecked with loaded firearms to such a degree that wherever Huberti was sitting or standing within his home, he could just reach over and get a gun.
How?
In November of 1982, Huberti was laid off from his welding job at Babcock and Wilcox, causing him to become a despondent over his dire financial situation and general inability to provide for his family. Shortly after being made redundant, Huberti placed a loaded pistol against his head and threatened to shoot himself. Etna successfully dissuaded her husband from shooting himself, although he later remarked to her, "You should have let me shoot myself." Unable to find alternate employment in Ohio, James and Etna Huberti sold their home in 1983 for just $12,000 in cash, with the buyer assuming their $48,000 mortgage. Shortly thereafter, they applied for residency in Mexico. He informed family acquaintances of his intention to relocate to Tijuana, in search of employment opportunities, confidently stating, "We're going to show them who's boss." I don't know why I did that voice. When Huberti and his family moved from Ohio to Tijuana in October of 1983, he left all but the most essentials of his family possessions in storage in Ohio, but ensured that he brought his huge collections of guns, ammunition, and survival supplies with him. According to published reports, Huberti's wife and daughter embraced their new environs and became friendly with their neighbors, although Huberti, who spoke a little Spanish, was sullen and quiet. Unable to find employment in Tijuana, Huberti quickly regretted his decision to relocate to Mexico. Within 3 months, his family relocated to California, where they rented an apartment within the Cottonwood Apartments. The fact his family were the only Anglo-Americans within this apartment complex irritated Huberti, who was notably ignorant to his neighbors. Shortly thereafter, Huberti obtained employment as a security guard, and the family relocated to a two-bedroom apartment on Avril Road in April. Approximately 2 weeks prior to July 18th, the day of the shooting, Huberti and one of his daughters were injured in a traffic accident, resulting in Huberti suffering neck injuries. He was dismissed from his job on July 10th. His employers informed Huberti the reason for his dismissal were his poor work performance and noted general instability. The day after the San Ysidro McDonald's massacre, reporters visited James Huberti's father in Canton, Ohio to gather further information about his son. Having discussed his son's childhood and the family's religious background, Earl Huberti pointed to a painting of a lost sheep by the Jordan River before beginning to weep, informing reporters, "Yesterday was the worst day of my life. I feel so sorry for those people." Huberti's body was cremated on July 23rd, 1984. No official religious service was observed throughout this act. His ashes were returned to his widow and later interred to his home state of Ohio. In the weeks following the massacre, Huberti's wife and daughter received numerous death threats, forcing them to temporarily reside with a family friend. Etna Huberti and her daughters initially relocated from San Ysidro to Chula Vista, where Zilia and Cassandra enrolled in school under assumed names. 1 year later, the family moved to the town of Spring Valley. Because of the sheer number of victims, local funeral homes had to use San Ysidro, maybe that's how you pronounce it. Maybe the Y is silent. Whatever, civic center to hold wakes for each victim. The local parish, Mount Carmel Church, were forced to back-to-back funeral masses in order that each of the dead could be buried in a timely manner. On August 2nd, San Diego Police Chief William Colander held a press conference to disclose the results of the San Diego Police Department's inquiry into their response to the massacre. The fact an estimated 73 minutes had elapsed between the time the first police officer had arrived at the restaurant and Huberti's death. The result of this internal inquiry found that although the arrival of SWAT team members was delayed by rush hour traffic, the police acted appropriately in their method of response. Colander stated any suggestion police should have stormed the restaurant was ludicrous, adding that officers had been unable to obtain a clear view of the gunman because windows had been spiderwebbed by bullet holes, making visibility in direct sunlight difficult. Colander finished his report by stating, "I believe the operation was handled the way it should have been handled." When questioned in regards to the actual motive behind Huberti's murder spree, Colander dismissed any notion of racial motives behind the massacre, informing reporters he didn't like anybody. Several police officers who responded to the scene of the San Ysidro McDonald's massacre suffered symptoms including sleep withdrawal, loss of memory, and guilt in the months following the incident. A study commissioned by the National Institute of Mental Health and conducted by the chief psychologist of the San Diego Police Department in 1985 concluded several officers suffered post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of the incident. Within 2 days of the San Ysidro McDonald's massacre, the restaurant had been refurbished and renovated. The restaurant planned to again open for business in the hopes that, as one employee commented, the building would become just another McDonald's. Following discussions between community leaders and executives, a decision was reached on July 24th that the restaurant would not reopen. The renovated restaurant was publicly demolished on July 28th. Following the closure and demolition of the restaurant, McDonald's donated the ground to the city with the stipulation that no restaurant be constructed upon the site. For over 4 years, alternative plans to convert the site into either a memorial park or a shrine to the dead were considered. The land was sold in February 1988 to Southwestern College for $136,000, with the agreement that a 300-square-foot area in front of the campus extension, the college intended to construct, be set aside as a permanent memorial to the 21 victims who died in the massacre. McDonald's later constructed another restaurant close to the site of the massacre upon West San Ysidro Boulevard. The restaurant chain also announced a commitment to donate $1 million to the Survivors Fund, with the widow of McDonald's founders, Ray Kroc, also adding a personal contribution of $100,000 to this fund. Amidst impromptu protests from San Ysidro residents, Edna Huberti received the first payout for this fund. I don't know why. A permanent memorial to those killed in the massacre was formally unveiled on December 13, 1990. The memorial consisted of 21 hexagonal white marble pillars ranging in height from 1 to 6 feet, each bearing the name of one of the victims. The sculpture was designed by a former Southwestern College student named Roberto Valdez, who said of his inspiration for the design, "The 21 hexagons represent each person that died, and they are different heights representing the variety of ages and races of the people involved in the massacre. They are bonded together in the hopes that the community, in a tragedy like this, will stick together like they did." The monument is located at 460 West San Ysidro Boulevard. Each anniversary of the massacre sees the monument is decorated with flowers. On the 3 days, people of the Mexican heritage observed the Day of the Dead. Candles and offerings were brought on behalf of the victims. As a result of the massacre, the city of San Diego increased training for special units and purchased more powerful firearms in order to better equip police to respond to scenarios in this magnitude. According to one officer who confessed to feeling inadequate because he had been equipped with a .38 caliber revolver on the day of the massacre, quote, "The time had come where you had to have a full-time, committed, and dedicated, highly trained, well-equipped team able to respond rapidly anywhere in the city." Several family members of those killed, along with the survivors of the massacre, filed lawsuits against McDonald's and local franchises in the Superior Court of California, County of San Diego. And the court eventually consolidated these lawsuits and then dismissed them before a trial on a defense motion for summary judgment. The plaintiffs appealed. On July 25th, 1987, the California Court of Appeals affirmed summary judgment for the defendants, ruling McDonald's or any other business has no duty of care to protect patrons from an unforeseeable assault by a murderous madman, and the implemented security measures typically used by restaurants to deter criminals, such as guards and closed-circuit television cameras, could not have possibly deterred the perpetrator because he did not care about his own survival.
Yeah.
The final lawsuits were dismissed on August 1991. In July 1986, Edna Huberti filed a lawsuit against both McDonald's and her husband's longtime former employee, Babcock & Wilcox. The civil suit seeking $5 million in damages asserting her husband's murder spree had been triggered by a combination of a poor diet, and her husband working around highly poisonous metals without adequate protection over a course of many years. The suit specifically cited that no traces of either drugs or alcohol had been discovered in Huberti's body at his autopsy, negating any possibility of his actions were influenced by either factor, and that the alleged accrual of the high levels of lead and cadmium discovered in Huberti's body at his autopsy had most likely accumulated via an ongoing exposure to the fumes inhaled during the 13 years he had been employed as a welder without sufficient respiratory protection by Babcock and Wilcox. And that a combination of Huberti's exposure to these chemicals with his lingering high levels of monosodium glutamate MSG.
Yeah.
In the staple of McDonald's foods he had regularly consumed, had induced delusions and an uncontrollable rage. I get half of that. The welder part, not the MSG.
The MSG part's bullshit, but
the lawsuit was dismissed in 1987.
Yeah.
Edna Huberti died of breast cancer in 2003. Survivor Alberto Leos later became a police officer. He served in several police departments in the South Bay region of San Diego County. Leos later joined the San Diego Police Department. Here are some notes that were at the bottom of the articles that go back up to the top, but I thought they were interesting enough to add. Edna Huberti did not take the statement that her husband was going hunting for humans, seriously, as he had often made remarks of his nature throughout the course of their marriage. Prior to shooting several of his victims, Huberti would shout accusations or insults. The bullets fired by Charles Foster was one of five fired at Huberti in the duration of his massacre. One co-worker would later recollect that upon being notified of the impending closure of an engineering firm, Huberti had made a comment indicating that if he was unable to provide for his family, he intended to commit suicide and take everyone with him. Within a year of his incident, Edna would remark to both police and the media her regrets in not letting her husband kill himself on this occasion. The occasion when he tried to...
Yeah, no, I can't remember.
I mean, yeah. The day after the massacre, Edna Huberti speculated to reporters her husband's motives for the shooting had been an attempt to get back at society he was trying to make society hurt the way he was hurting. James and Edna Huberti had regularly eaten McDonald's fast food throughout the course of their marriage. That was the last one.
Oh, that's whack.
Yeah. Ow. So that was my story.
Jesus fucking Christ. Okay, well, I am not going to do what I normally do for this, because this is a whole different thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want you to know that, so when I start saying these things, you understand that I'm not, like, you know, doing the normal things.
Okay, what are you doing?
So, I, like, can't really, I don't know, I can't, like, pick, like, a single thing to, like, do the normal mm-hmm. things. It seems too, like, weird to do that with this, especially just because it's like so, I don't know, like it's not that serial killers aren't fucked up and like that whole thing, but this is just way more like, I don't know,
I agree
it's different.
Mm-hmm.
It hits different. So I don't know, I was just thinking of a bunch of stuff to like talk about, but to talk about a show, and this is a show that I know I, like, just won't be able to use for anything else, because it's, like, if I related to something, it would guaranteed be, like, the exact story.
Okay.
Because it's, like, a based on a true story type of thing. You know what I'm talking about. It's, you'll know when I say it.
Okay.
But so, like, the show I'm just talking about is Mindhunter.
Oh.
Where it's, like, about mm-hmm. But the first scene of Mindhunter, like, season one, episode one, is yeah. when it's, like, the hostage negotiation.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I was thinking about that and how it was, like...
We'll run through the scene. So the main guy shows up. He's a hostage negotiator for the FBI.
Yep.
Sorry. I'm eating a sandwich. And there's a man... Is he naked?
Yeah. You can eat your sandwich. I know.
Hit it, girl.
I was like, this is my bro. I remember the scene. But,
Sorry. There's like stuff in my throat.
Okay.
I can't breathe. It's fine.
Continue. Okay. No, so yeah, the main character of Mindhunter. He is a hostage negotiator, and he shows up at the scene, and he starts, like, this is at a point in time, it's like the early 70s, before a lot of the, like, groundbreaking research that changed the way, like, the FBI handles, like, these types of cases with sort of, like, mentally ill people, like, people who are just, like, not... Like, they're not thinking in the conventional way a person would think.
Mm-hmm.
It's, like, deviant mindsets of people.
Yeah.
So, this FBI agent, he is also the author of the book Mindhunter that then became the show. But he is, like, talking to the captor. The captor, yeah. The guy who's, like, holding people hostage. And he's asking all these questions. And he's trying to calm him down, and he's not, like, he's asking, like, if he needs anything or stuff like that. And it's kind of just, like, this weird viewpoint, but you kind of, again, it gets into, like, the basic kind of thought process of, like, all how it kind of goes with serial killers, which now that I'm thinking about this and, like, analyzing it, is, like, the perfect first scene of that whole show.
Mm-hmm, I agree.
Is because, like, they think that they're, like, the biggest victim ever. Like,
yeah.
Everything is, like, bad happening to them. And again, when you have, like, a hostage situation, like, it's, for some of these police officers, it's very hard for them to understand that, and they're being, you know, they're escalating the situation, but then it's, like, this guy, let me look up the actual man's name, because I feel bad for, like, not knowing it, even though I love the show.
The main character, Mindhunter?
Yeah.
I don't know his name.
Isn't that terrible?
I know, we're terrible.
We watched Mindhunter.
In my defense, I don't know any of the characters' names of Mindhunter.
Mindhunter.
Listen to us, Google.
But anyways, so he's, like, taking the whole different approach of, like, you have to talk him down. And I think even, like, you going back into the background of him and, like, how he, like, is thinking about things,
mm-hmm.
it just completely lines up with that. Holden Ford, that's the name of the...
Holden, yeah. Okay.
I knew Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And then Wendy. I know.
From Wendy's the lesbian.
Wendy's the lesbian. That's, like, the main three. No one else really matters.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, so Holden Ford. I always thought Holden was his last name watching the show.
Me too.
Because it doesn't...
You call him Agent Holden.
Yeah. Usually everyone says...
Everyone's like, Holden.
Yeah. But yeah. So, anyways, to just talk more about Mindhunter and...
Wait, we never finished it.
We never finished
it. He's negotiating.
Oh, yeah.
And the man comes out and he yells, "Can you see me?" Because he thinks he's invisible.
Yeah. So it's a very... And he's asking for his wife. And
she's in the taxi, right?
She's in the taxi, and they're like, and Ford doesn't want her to come out because that will set him off.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it's just too unpredictable a situation. And, like, the rest of the cops are just like, just give him his wife. Like, that's what he's asking for. And he's like, I don't know. Like, it just is a very tricky situation. And basically what ends up happening is he shoots himself, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he shoots himself, and then... I think, like, they get the hostage and stuff, but then, obviously, like, he still dies, but, like, again, the hostage came out safe. But it just was, like, you could see the, like, shift. It's, like, a scene that perfectly shows the shift of, like, people just kind of going crazy, almost. Like, mm-hmm. I don't, like, obviously, there were still, like, hostage situations before, but just there's, like, some reason, like, that, like, 70s and 80s post, like, Vietnam, like, that era, total shift in, like, thinking.
Yeah.
And, like, all that. But, oh, man, it's terrible. I don't know. But Mindhunter is a show, just because I will never be able to talk about it on this podcast ever, because it's a show about actual serial killers, and that's...
That we've already spoken about.
That we've already spoken about, so it's a total cop-out for me. You know, but it's a really great show. The psychology of it, it's like a very wordy show. You have to pay attention to it, but it's really great. The first season.
It reminds me of, it's not as good, but like an Aaron Sorkin-like-esque script.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of speaking, but like Aaron Sorkin, I don't know if anyone knows that, but he did The Social Network and Newsroom and West Wing. It's a lot of banter, a lot of talking.
Oh, yeah.
You have to pay attention. Mindhunter, not as much banter and talking, but definitely a lot. You have to pay attention to get, like,
yeah,
what's going on. Because, like, half the time, at least for me, like, they don't say initially who they're going to interview, because the whole plot is, like, he's traveling around and he's interviewing serial killers.
Yep.
Or so they will be named. And, like, I know a lot about serial killers, clearly. So, like, half the time I'm like, who's he talking about? Who's he about to interview? And then it's like, Son of Sam, got it.
Yeah. Oh, man.
And there's a lesbian.
Yeah. No, I mean,
she's a cool lady.
Yeah, the woman who we're talking about is, she's a psychology professor. And they bring her in because at the, like, beginning of the series when it's just starting, there's just, like, not, like, and even, like, they go in and show, like, Quantico and, like, all the training, and there's just not an attention to people like that. Like,
yeah.
It's
not about why they're doing it, it's...
Yeah,
it's,
like, so they're trying to understand, like, this type of mindset of, like...
Repeat sexually motivated murderers.
Yeah. And also, I think it just kind of, that type of mindset goes in. Because, like, also, like, everything you were saying about, like, this man was, like, textbook to, like, everything you hear about people who, like, go out and shoot people. It, like...
No, I know, 100%.
It's so textbook. So it's kind of, it was, like...
Yeah, he was, like, if I'm going down, everyone's coming with me. He thought everyone was out to get him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, it definitely
he ate, like, at McDonald's. No.
But, yeah, it's just so, like, right along with, like, everything that's always said.
Wendy Carr, sorry, is played by Anna Torv, who's from Fringe. And I watched a lot of Fringe. Like, a lot of Fringe.
Like, a lot?
Like, I watched it all in, like, my, like, sophomore year of high school. And, like, I went crazy for Fringe, sorry. I love her.
Yeah.
And then Jonathan Groff.
Yeah.
He's from Glee.
Well, he's from Glee. He also he's in the original cast of Hamilton.
Is he?
Yeah. He plays the king. King George. So, like,
I didn't know that.
If you ever listened to Hamilton, that's him singing.
He's also in, I think, was it Book of Mormon?
He's in Spring Awakening.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's another, that's with Lea Michele from Glee.
Yeah, I know who, yeah.
Yeah.
He's also in Glee, so. He sings Bohemian Rhapsody. Wow.
Oh, you made me watch that scene.
While Quinn is giving birth.
That was a terrible, terrible scene. I hated it. It's
so great.
Awful.
It's amazing. Everyone should watch it.
Yeah.
Mindhunter, everyone should also watch that one.
Yeah, it's a very good show.
Got an 8.6 out of 10.
Yeah. Second season, so far, I'm not as into it, but that also might be because
we've been spreading it out.
Yeah, we can't binge watch it.
So thin in our life. Like, we could binge watch it, but we physically can't, is what we're saying.
Yeah.
Like, it's on Netflix. It's available for
binge watching. Oh, yeah, we could binge watch it, but, like,
because we're committed to each other and watching it together. And we are all unavailable for everything, so...
Yeah.
It's hard.
Listen, we haven't been able to keep up with our shows ever since school started.
I mean, my shows.
Because, one, we no longer live together, and we no longer have free time after work. Because we had 9-to-5 little jobs.
We got off at 5, and we came home, and we're like, let's watch some shows.
I fucking...
Can't wait to have a 9-to-5.
I missed the summer so much.
The summer was nice.
It was, like, looking back, I was like, oh, I was like, I didn't do that much, but now I'm just like, it was so wonderful, though.
Oh, yeah, it was great. I got home from work, didn't have to care about anything.
I cannot care in the world.
No homework.
I was just thinking this the other day, because I, like, haven't cooked, like, at all, like, since school has started, except for, like, Friday I was making food. But I was like, over the summer I could just, like, cook so easily. And, like, made this, like, nice food. I was eating so much healthier because it's, like, the summer, so there's vegetables around. And, like, I wasn't, like, I knew, like, my schedule really well. So I could just, like, oh, yeah, this won't go bad. So I am not afraid to buy vegetables at, like, the grocery store. Oh, it was so nice.
You know, adults are out here saying, like, you got it easy. You only work a part-time job. Like, you don't get a vacation once you're an adult. Well, like,
but you
I work so much more now.
Every single person I hear from, and again, I'm sure once I, like, am old, like, obviously being in college is, like, a whole other thing, and it's really fun.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, everyone I hear who's, like, is recently graduated and has a regular job fucking loves it.
Yeah. They I feel love like the it. Point is you... Like, with us, we take so much home. Like, yeah, we have classes from, like, 9 to 5 or whatever. And, like, we work 20 hours a week or whatever, you know? But, like, afterwards, we still have to go home and do 5-7 classes worth of homework.
That's the thing. All of my classes, all of the work happens outside of class.
Yeah.
Like, all of it. There's no, like, I mean, like, with the exception of, like, occasionally, but, like, it's all stuff you do outside of class.
Yeah, like, it's 9:40 right now. I have to go home, do a whole entire quiz, finish a brief for an advertising project.
Yeah.
And then get up for class tomorrow.
Yeah. Oh, no.
It's not to mention my extracurriculars.
Yeah. We need to learn how to say no to people. That's the goal.
It's like I'm only in 2 clubs, you know? That's you'd think I'd have more free time.
You would think.
That's what you would think.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But, I don't know. I would say, I was like, the other day, I was like, I really... Because I have, like, 2 jobs on campus, and I was like, sometimes I'm just like, I don't work that much at, like, the office. But I'm like, but also... Why, if I'm going to drop something from my schedule to, like, have more time, why would I drop the thing I'm getting paid for?
Yeah.
It's like, no.
Drop a club. Not saying I'm going to drop any clubs if anyone from my clubs or organizations that I belong in are listening to my podcast.
Don't be a snitch.
Don't tell anyone. Yeah. No, I'm not going to drop my clubs. I'm just going to... I think we need to learn to really take time for ourselves. Like... I don't... My clubs and organizations that I'm involved in, like, everything that is an event is a mandatory event.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you, like, have work or class. When it's the weekend, I don't work.
And you don't have class.
And I don't have class.
But you have things to do.
But I have
class.
To do so much fucking homework. But I can't say, oh, I have to do homework as an excuse. Which was fine, but now we have, like, 13 things every weekend.
Yeah.
And I'm like, can I get a couple hours so that I can do my homework so that I don't fail my classes?
Yeah.
Like, I love my club, and I love all the events we're doing because a lot of it's community service. Mm. And I do like that, but it's also just like, hey, I need to do my homework.
Yeah.
And it's really hard. I don't know. And then also I have to deal with, like, children, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. I can't believe. I never really thought that about how much I enjoyed this summer.
The summer was so great.
It was so wonderful.
Also, like, I got paid so much.
Yeah.
I'm not getting paid to go to class. I'm so tired. College is great and it's fun and I'm educated, but, like, I'm so exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
I'm making less money than I'm spending on rent.
Yeah. That's the other thing. They cap us out.
At 20.
At 20, which, I mean, I wouldn't have time to work.
I don't have time to work the 20 is the problem.
Yeah. Like, it's not like there's the time. I just want...
I have classes... I have to sleep every once in a while.
The allure of college is done for me.
If you are poor, college is not fun.
Yeah.
Like, you have to get a job on campus, and you want to pass your classes. You know? I don't know. I was sitting at the table today in my building, and everyone's like, oh, I skipped that class. And I was like, why are you all skipping classes? Maybe it's just me, and I had perfect attendance in high school, because I'm a psychopath. But I don't know. Skipping a class stresses me the fuck out.
The only classes that I, like, I'm in a different situation because I am an art student, and, like, a lot of times our classes, like, it'll be like, oh, this, like, we have class A and it's a total work day. So it's like, I know for a fact I'm not doing shit in that class.
Yeah, it's different. We don't have that shit.
Yeah. So, like, if it's a, like, I've never usually skipped lectures unless I, like, have a reason to, or like I am sick or some shit.
Like, I'm not saying I haven't skipped lectures.
Yeah.
Because sometimes organizational behavior gets real boring.
Yeah. And you but I understand what you're there. Saying. Like, if you skip a class, if I skip a
it's
class,
like, I'm paying for this.
Well, and also I just get so much anxiety about, like, missing something and then showing up and everyone's like, oh, the little rat's back. You know what I mean?
It's like, also, what am I going to do during that time period? I have, like, at least 2 classes a day and I have a job every day. So I'm going to be on campus, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes, I could be doing homework, but I could also be in class, half listening to that lecture, also doing homework.
Yeah.
I don't know. College is very stressful, and we're very stressed, and if you can't tell, we're very stressed. We are very stressed. And we're still here putting this podcast on because we love it.
Yeah.
We enjoy it. And we know that somebody's out there that listens to it and must enjoy it, too.
Yeah, I would say, honestly, at this point, it's like, we are both, you're more busy than me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just our schedules just don't line up at all.
Yeah.
But, like,
this is the only time Tess and I get to hang out.
Yeah, it straight up is. Like, it truly is, besides when I go and we harass each other at work for, like, 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And that's not, you know.
That's not hanging out. That's harassing each other at
work. Like, we haven't watched a movie in so long.
I know. It's upsetting.
I know. And all the, like, again, I know my roommates don't listen to this. Because they're little rats, even though I told them to. But to be fair, it would be weird if they just listened to my voice while I wasn't there. I can understand that. I won't be mad. But I was like, every time I watch a movie with them, I'll be like, hey, what's happening? And you know how you give, like, these crazy long explanations?
Yeah.
They'll be like, oh, and, like, one word explanation. I'm like, that didn't fill me into the entire backstory of the movie, so I'm dissatisfied with your explanation.
Yeah.
My one roommate was like, she was watching Good Omens. I, like, came in, like, halfway through an episode. I was like, what's happening? She's like, oh, they're at, like, a park. I'm like, excuse me.
Good Omens is so hard to follow, too. It's like, well, you see, this angel did this thing, like, 80 years ago, and now they switch children, and no one knows what's going on, but that kid's got a dog now, you know?
I wonder if there's any case that I could use for that show, because that show
for Good Omens,
slapped.
I'm sure there is.
Yeah, that show's real good.
I only got, like, 3 episodes in. I really need to finish it, but look at me. I have no time.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry about ranting about the lack of our free time, but... It's true.
It's true.
And we don't get us wrong, we really love this podcast, and we really love doing this for you guys, and we really love the degrees we are getting, because then we can be employed, and then we can make loads of money, and then we can continue doing this podcast, because we love it and enjoy it, and we love all our listeners, because you guys are really what makes us keep going in life. One of your roommates just entered your house. Anyway, it's fall. We went apple picking, the leaves are changing colors, and the temperature is not going to get higher than 70 degrees.
Ugh, hell yeah.
Bust out your sweaters, guys. It's time.
It's the peak season of nice fall weather before the real dark times come.
the real dark times,
Although the only thing is, though, December is the best snow month because then it's Christmas and you get, like, the little seasonal stuff. And I also, not to be that person, but love Christmas music, so...
This year, I might finally build a snowman. However, we were watching Frozen last night. Well, I was watching it for about 2 seconds because my roommates put it on.
Mm-hmm.
And the song, the "Do You Wanna Build a Snowman?" I was like, that's gonna be me at your door when it snows. And my roommate was like, we're not gonna build a snowman with you. It's gonna be cold. And I was like, okay.
Listen, I have a little backyard now. We can do it out there.
Oh my God.
Yeah, we can. Because I would say it will be easy because we don't have to, like, go out into, like, other people's backyards. We can just do it out in the bog.
Cool.
And then Scarecrow Jones can walk by.
I have still never built a snowman or made a snow angel. So I've been in the snow for 2 years. Why have I not?
Listen, we will check back in once it snows here, but which might be January is usually the best snow month.
When we do build a snowman, you will get many photos.
Yeah. It will. Listen, we're keeping up that cute Instagram content.
I went to a social media conference. They told me what to do. We get it. You want more personal photos of us? We will provide.
We will provide. We take so many gay pictures. It's ridiculous.
And we're not even, you know, together. That's fun. That's funky. We're best friends. Mm-hmm. I just want to end this with, like, a quote that I heard at the deli that I texted to you. I was standing at work. I wasn't working, but I was standing there. Like, I wasn't on my shift. I wasn't just, like, not working. And this little cluster of what I believe to be freshmen were behind me.
Uh-huh.
And this girl looks at this boy and goes, "Your parents are totally not boomers if they appreciate, like, the gays." And I was like, what the fuck did I just hear?
Oh my god.
Because first, I always turn my head when I hear the term boomers.
Yeah.
Because us marketers and everyone else love making fun of boomers.
Oh yeah.
It's like, that's real boomer of you right now. But,
like, making as for the baby boomer target market, it's like, they like America.
They like freedom. Pissing on the youth.
Yeah, it's like throwback rock and roll.
Fuck them.
Yeah, it's like back in Vietnam.
All the shit we say is just like the fucking boomers. Like minion.
Like every customer profile on a boomer is just so funny.
We're so aggressive about it.
It's either like a hardcore like motorcycle riding guy or like a very racist white lady.
And I sway towards the very racist white lady whenever I make my boomer ads.
Mm.
Cause that's easier for me. but yeah, and I just thought it was so weird because I turned around and I was like, what the fuck is happening over here? And she was like on her tippy toes. She was in his face.
Yeah.
And she was like, "Your parents are not boomers if they appreciate the gays." I was like, what the fuck?
Well, they were born between the years 1950 and 1962. So I don't know about that.
Like, oh my weird. God. But yeah. Anyway, thank you for listening. Don't kill anyone. And you know, thanks.
You know, yeah. Also, this episode was kind of a little...
Sorry about our whack. Tangent.
Obviously, we had a tangent, we had a really interesting start, and I did not really do my job, so...
But that's what you're here for.
Yeah. That personal content.
We really brought us everyone down, and now we're trying to build everyone back up.
Yeah.
With that humor and that bickering, that Aaron Sorkin-like bickering that Tess and I have, because every time we talk to people, they're always like, "Man, I like the way you guys talk to each other."
Literally,
you should start a podcast.
Oh, and then everyone always does say that. They're like, it randos too that don't even know
yeah.
us. Like, there was a. Like, I remember this one girl from Tinder. Actually, two people from Tinder, both over, was like, "Oh my god, you guys are so cute. Like, wow." And I'm like, okay.
Weird.
I'm like, alright, great, cool.
It's called being friends. Look it up.
Yeah.
If you don't talk to your friends like me and Tess talk to each other, you're not real friends.
No.
Anyway, sorry, this episode's probably pretty long. Thank you so much for listening.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.